Good afternoon, everybody. Loss of life on Earth. And I took this subtitle, The Role of Universities in Facilitating Societal Transformation, to No Net Loss and Net Gain of Biodiversity. It works. Good. So throughout the history, basically, scholars and academics have provided society with information. Evidence-based information. That's our business. So business of universities is really to provide evidence. Can you lift me up a bit in the screen?
Lift you up.
Can you move that to there?
Oh.
Good. Thank you. So one of the roles that we play, we academics, we take part, for instance, in different kinds of knowledge-producing institutions, like IPES, which is the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. In those institutions, we kind of pool information together in a digestible form for policymakers and for the society in general, so that they can make educated decisions. That's the business of universities. We train specialists for these kinds of institutions. In Finland, we also have one of such institutions, and it's called Finnish Nature Panel, Suomen Luontopaneeli. This is an independent expert group that is tasked to support policy planning and decision making. There is currently the Nature Conservation Act is being reformed, and the Finnish Nature Panel is going to be put into the law so that it will be, the task will be kind of law binding. But then we will be an independent body tasked to support nature policy making and planning. So let's start from the very beginning. So what do we understand with biodiversity? It is basically life in all of its forms and shapes. And we have to remember that life has started once and it has continued thereafter about 4 billion years, diversifying constantly. Biodiversity is life. Diversity that we observe today is the result of life passing from one generation to another from the start, 4 billion years ago. And this continuum has been kind of metaphorically described as the tree of life, in which each tip of a twig represents a species that are all connected to each other through the branches and the trunk of that tree of life. So basically, we are all the same. It's one life that we are part of. The earliest kind of the metaphor came from Charles Darwin in 1830, or that's the earliest that we know that has been that this thinking has been going on. So this picture that we have here is from his kind of draft books, where he draw, I think, and then the figure. I think it's quite beautiful academic achievement, I think, and a figure. Then these two knights, Sir Robert Watson and Sir Partha Dasgupta, they have been saying this year and the year before that biodiversity loss is not only an environmental issue. It is an issue of sustainable development, economy, national and international security, justice, rights, moral, and ethics. Basically, almost everything that we do is about biodiversity loss. And the bottom line is that humanity is unconditionally dependent on the other forms of life on Earth. We cannot escape this fact. Okay, so what is the state of affairs globally at the moment as we know it? We humans, we have degraded or destroyed a large part of nature, ecosystems, and species. The loss of biodiversity and ecosystem services is now faster than ever in the history of humankind. Destruction threatens the well-being and existence of humanity itself. These are almost the words of Antonio Guterres last week, than when he was opening the, or this week basically, when he was opening the COP26 in Glasgow. It has been said by the world leaders already out loud that this is a question about the future of humanity that we are now facing. Incremental change towards sustainable production and consumption is no longer enough to take us to the path of sustainable development. So no small adjustment is enough anymore. We have to do more than that. The only option is to try to make some transformative changes, systemic changes that we change the whole system. Otherwise, we are not going to make it. If we look more carefully, 1/3 or more of the land area of Earth is already converted to agriculture to produce food for us. Well, 80% of that area is actually to produce feed for animals that we then eat. By 2050, it has been projected that the animal consumption of animal products is going to double from that it was in 2000. So the area that we need land for that production is going to increase a lot. Less than 1/4 of the ice-free land is spared from significant human impact at the moment. By 2050, this will decline to 10%. And then at that point, all of the area we have left is inhospitable terrain for life, not only for us, but life in general. So this is deserts, mountains, and tundra. Nothing much can live there. In the first part of this century or millennia, land degradation caused annual global emissions were up to 4.4 gigatons of CO2, which was about 10 to 15% of all the man-made emissions that there were. So this is the land degradation that is causing this. And main reason for this is that we are degrading the agricultural soils by using them incorrectly. Forest degradation, we are cutting down the forests, we are degrading them. Deforestation, we are putting pavement on forests, and drainage of peatlands, in Finland in particular, for production of wood. Just day before yesterday, there was some good news from Glasgow. 110 states' heads said that, okay, it's time to stop deforestation and we will do it by 2030. Okay, good. It is really a good news because we need commitments from the leaders so that we academics, that we then have something to back up when we say that, look, we have to start doing something. So we need these kinds of declarations, even though they themselves do nothing. I took one slide here for the state of affairs in Finland, because we often think that we are in a bird's nest or something like that. I don't know what the word is in English, really. In Finnish, it's lintukoto. So, but basically, how do things really look like in Finland? 77% of forest ecosystem types are threatened. They are red listed in the assessment. And 68% of their condition has been lost. And with condition, we mean those characteristics that are important for biodiversity have been eradicated from the forest. 56% of peatland ecosystem types are threatened, and 43% of their condition has been lost. 48% of all ecosystem types together are threatened, and 61% of their condition has been lost. 12% of the species in Finland that have been evaluated are threatened. So that's 2,700 species altogether. They are under the risk of extinction, so disappearing from Finland. And if we take the whole number of species that we have in Finland, which is about 48,000, and assume that the same threat exists throughout the life, then it's 5,700 species that we are risking at the moment that we are going to lose from Finland. So we do have many conventions and agreements, but without immediate investments on implementation, we will not meet any of the targets. And we have seen already, we didn't meet any of the targets of the Aichi biodiversity targets 2020. All of them were missed globally. So we do make these pledges, but we don't implement. And this is where we need to do better. We have to change somehow to make this implementation happen. And there, maybe we have to climb down from the ivory tower as academics and talk to the society that, look, now we have to start making some changes. And here we have all these ideas that you can take and start implementing. So at the global level, it has been estimated that 1 million species are under risk of extinction, and 82% of wild mammal biomass is already lost. By the end of the century, climate will be 3, perhaps even 5 Celsius warmer than it has been. By 2050, we will lose 38 to 46% of all biodiversity on the planet, with business as usual. So undomesticated life on the planet is dying out. We are driving the planet towards the 6th mass extinction. So what? I mean, let's just live our lives and continue. Who cares? Just one example. So 75% of food crops, so all the species that we use to produce food, and 35% of the total food production volume, so the mass of food that we produce, needs a pollinator, which in most cases is an insect. In Finland, for example, there are already signs that lack of pollination decreases the oilseed rape and currant crops. So if we had more pollinators, if we had more variety of pollinators, we would have more crops to feed on. So even in Finland, it is already showing. In some parts of the world, we have eaten all the birds, then we have sprayed all the trees to kill all the insects, and we climb to the tree and start hand pollinating the fruit trees. Is this the future we want? Humanity really is threatened. Degradation of the Earth's land surface through human activities is negatively impacting the well-being of 2 out of 5 people already. This is at least 3.2 billion people. By 2050, land degradation and climate change together are predicted to reduce crop yields by an average of 10% and up to 50% in certain regions, while the global human population will increase by 30%. And the population, unfortunately, is increasing right at the same place where the food production capacity is reducing the most. Therefore, by 2050, the combination of land degradation and climate change are likely to force 50 to 700 million people to migrate. And just recently, maybe 2 weeks ago, the World Bank released an estimate that about 250 million people are likely to migrate. So narrowing down the range. So post 2020 global biodiversity framework, because we need to have something. So negotiations are actually going on as we speak. Here is a part of the January 2020 version. It was called the zero draft of the framework. And I just highlighted here one bit of that document. There is a goal for 2030, no net loss by 2030 in the integrity of ecosystems. So this text is still under negotiation, but now it seems like we are going towards no net loss, or we were going towards no net loss in January 2020. There is now the first draft that came out in July 21. And what has actually happened between the two rounds is that we increased the ambition. So now we have the integrity of all ecosystems is enhanced. And instead of no net loss, we are actually saying net gain in the integrity is what we are going for. So we increase the ambition, which is good, of course, because that's what we really need. Here we have a figure, illustration about the biodiversity loss. There is a timeline, and then there are three different scenarios. We don't concentrate on yellow, but we have a couple of words about the two others. If we do continue business as usual, then biodiversity loss will continue until we are in deep trouble. However, if we increase conservation efforts, if we do more sustainable production, more sustainable consumption, and what I added to this is that if we take obligatory ecological compensation, if we adopt that, then there's a chance that we actually go somewhere. No net loss of biodiversity relative to reference here is the thick red arrow, meaning that if we look 2010, about 10 years ago, we have lost biodiversity since then, but if we want to have no net loss reference to 2010, then we will have to do all these actions that I have here and more, and then maybe no net loss can be reached around 2070. And if we continue doing stuff, then net gain of biodiversity thereafter is possible. Okay, then ecological compensation and why we have no other option. Now this relates to what Samba was already talking. It is impossible to immediately halt absolute biodiversity loss. And absolute here is the key word. This is because human population will increase by 30% by 2050 and 40 to 50% by the end of the century. And it is not right to request less developed countries to stop developing. They must be able to do so. And we know already that it's very challenging to reduce the material consumption in the more developed countries like Finland. We are very, very hard to do that. Hence, realistically, only no net loss can be achieved. So no loss is not a possibility at the moment, no net loss is a possibility. But it means that widespread adoption of ecological compensation really is the only option. Like, it's not worth debating whether we want it or not. If we want to stop biodiversity loss, we need ecological compensation. So the process of compensating for nature, the damage we caused to the nature, this is called ecological compensation, or there is another word, biodiversity offsetting, that is the same thing. And offsets can be produced by restoring previously degraded or damaged areas, or protecting areas that are under a pressure to become damaged. So two different ways. So traditional mitigation hierarchy, this is the same as what Sampo was talking, but from the perspective of biodiversity. So here we have an axis where we have a positive side for biodiversity or nature and a negative side. So we do something and it has a positive or negative effect. We do a mine and it has damage to the nature. And this is actually a picture from Talvivaara. So from our lintukoto, from our bird nest, this picture is coming from. So we have a damage to some degree. Then we do actions, we avoid and we mitigate to reduce the damage. So we avoid the damage completely and then try to mitigate some parts of it. After that, it has been said in the traditional mitigation hierarchy that we repair on site what we can. So we restore the areas. But then we have the residual damage that we cannot do anything about. And this residual, we want to compensate for. And when we do the same amount, we are talking about no net loss. When we do more, we talk about net gain. With a colleague of mine, we actually proposed that we have to throw this mitigation hierarchy in the trash bin and reconstruct it, basically so that we change the order of compensation and repair and use the repair. It is still done, but we use it for net gain. And I don't go into that in the detail, but you can find it from the paper. So here we have the rules of ecological compensation. Rather than five, like in climate change, we have 15 or so. First, we have the objectives that we have to decide. So these are decisions that have to be made in every single case of offsetting, biodiversity offsetting, if we want to succeed. First of all, we have to decide the degree of adherence to the mitigation hierarchy, how much to avoid before embarking on compensations. And this is exactly what Sampo was talking about. Where is the threshold when it is more profitable to start compensating than actually trying to avoid the mitigation? That's one way of looking at it. I have not been looking at it from that perspective in biodiversity, but I will in the future because of Sampo's talk. Then definition of no net loss. It sounds simple. No net loss is no net loss. But when you start considering that, okay, is it no net loss for every single species? Or is it no net loss on average for all species? Some species net gain, some species net loss, on average, no net loss. This is a very important decision because if you want to have it for all species, the requirement for ecological compensation is much bigger than it is if you want to have on average for all species. Degree of no net loss required. Do you want net positive? Do you want only partial compensation? These are decisions that we have to make. There is no scientific rule that can be used to decide this question. Then we have space. We have to think about the extent of implementation. So how large area do we need to implement those offsets to compensate the damages? And spatial context of valuation. It is not the same if we look at the Finnish red list or the global red list and use the red list as a basis for decision what to compensate. So that's spatial context of valuation. But then permanence is very important. The damage that we do when we build a railroad, it's basically permanent damage to nature. So all of the offsets need to be permanent as well. Time frame. What I mean with time frame, and I need to talk with Sampo because he didn't have time frame in the five. Time frame means that when do we want the no net loss to happen? When we do restoration, it is not immediate the benefit that we get. So the damage we do is pretty immediate. It's quite fast to destroy, but to get the gains, it takes decades. Even maybe a century before we actually get the forest to regrow or some other habitat to be restored. So this means that we have to decide when the no net loss will happen, because that influences the extent we have to do the restoration. Because if the time frame is very small, 5 years, we have to do huge areas of restoration, because that minimum gain that is done during the 5 years can be, it needs to be multiplied to a large area so that we get the bigger gain. If we take 50 years, for instance, it is too long for the reason that if we look back 50 years, it's half of the Finnish independence. That's too long time for anything to happen, really, to be feasible or reliable. Then time discounting, we tend to value things more that are close than far away. Same goes with the biodiversity. Then biodiversity measurement, we have to simplify. We cannot measure everything. How much to simplify and whether to account that as a multiplier or not. Trading up, well, that's easy. We can trade up already degraded area. If that's destroyed more, we can perhaps trade it up to better habitats. It's a detail. Then some of these other things about the actions, additionality, same as with the climate offsets. But then there is effectiveness of restoration offsets. We need to know how fast the ecosystem is recovering after the restoration. So we need to have functions for that. And that's the business of ecologists, that we can do it. Then effectiveness of avoided loss offsets, and also the baseline of loss that relates to this same issue. How much do we expect that business as usual, we are really degrading, if that can be counted as an offset? Leakage, of course. When we protect a forest in Finland, it does not influence the use of timber in the paper mills. So they will take the forest from somewhere else if we protect something. So paradoxically, this sounds like, okay, there is no point in conserving areas because that destruction is happening somewhere else anyways. So this needs to be taken into account when we calculate how much area needs to be protected if we want to use that as an offset. Okay, instrumental for the work for this part is Atte Moilanen, a good colleague of mine, and I'm very glad that we just got a Strategic Council funding to boost biodiversity offsets for the next 6 years. Okay, it is a license to trust, isn't it? This biodiversity offsetting. Well, I just claim that it is not license to trust. In practice, we already have that license. Basically, we need everything we build, we need a license in Finland, but the legislation has been written such that unless there is some particular reason not to give that permit, you will get it. So we have the license to trust. So therefore, ecological compensation can no longer give it to us because we already have it. So failure of compensation has been a rule rather than an exception. And this is a fact. Most of the cases globally have failed. It's not working, which is a problem. But the reason is incompetent planning and implementation, not ecological compensation as a process. So the people who are doing it do not know what they are doing. That's the reason. So it is not right to say that ecological compensation is failed. It's not. It's the implementation that is failed, not the process itself. So we have plenty of evidence that ecosystem restoration really works. It improves the quality or the condition of ecosystems. So there is no reason it would not work when the motivation is compensation. It will work if we do it correctly. So obligating ecological compensation from all who damage nature would bring the cost of damage visible, which is important. Because of course, people think only money in business and in general. So if we get this done, then it would create a natural incentive to implement earlier steps of the mitigation hierarchy. That is to avoid the loss, because the loss would not have a price. So we avoid that cost, of course. So I think that widespread adoption of ecological compensation, whether through voluntary actions or through regulation, which I prefer, is a necessity without which we will not be able to stop the biodiversity loss. That's the thesis. Let's have one slide about the deforestation. Yes. Return to deforestation. Did they actually think what it means? I spent yesterday afternoon and evening thinking, what does it mean if we want to stop deforestation by 2030? So in Finland, deforestation has been around 10 to 20,000 hectares a year. And during the last 10 years, it's about 20,000 hectares every year. That's not a small amount of area. It's clearing for fields and building infrastructures. It's not really forestry-related stuff. But on top of that, what I was thinking is that, okay, forest cutting is not considered deforestation, but we are constantly clear-cutting, clear-cut harvesting Finnish forests at the rate of over 1,000 hectares, 100,000 hectares per year. So this means that at the landscape level in Finland, we constantly have lost forest cover over several hundreds of thousands of hectares because of forestry. And still, it's not counted as forest loss. So something to think about there. So what would it require to stop? And I actually added here now net because of the reasons that I have been discussing earlier, deforestation. We are unlikely to be able to stop developing infrastructures. I said that already. So zoning for housing in every city need to be reconsidered. How can Jyväskylä build next suburb, Helsinki, all of the cities, if they don't take forest for that anymore? Construction of roads, railroads, shopping malls, parking lots, etc., all need to be reconsidered. Did they think about this when they said that, okay, let's stop deforestation? That we use that land all the time to these infrastructures. So reaching net zero deforestation by 2030 will be a challenge. But then I came up with this, that we probably need to start developing forest area compensation rules now. It's 8 years from now. The zoning plans that they are developing now for some windmill farms or something, they will be built in 2030 and beyond. So if we stop deforestation, we have to start thinking about these issues tomorrow, because now there is this pledge. Finally, last slide. We need to change the narrative of sustainability, because the three pillars of sustainability really are not equal. This is the task of universities. We have to challenge the talk that we talk in the society. Holistic sustainability, taking in the three pillars together. It's not like that. We need a societally fair sustainability transition back to the planetary boundaries that we have crossed, ensuring equitable and well-being over generations for all living beings, not only for humans, but for all living beings. We are the same living life. So economy has no intrinsic value, even though it seems in the political discussions and our everyday talk that it has, but it does not have an intrinsic value, and it needs to be reduced to a tool it is that can be used to facilitate the transformation. So we need economy, but it's not something that we want. We want something else. We should aspire planetary well-being. That's what we should aspire for. And here is the definition that actually the day before yesterday we got through or came out from a journal. Planetary well-being is a state in which the integrity of Earth system and ecosystem processes remain unimpaired to a degree that lineages can persist to the future as parts of ecosystems, and organisms, including humans, can realize their typical characteristics and capabilities. That is what planetary well-being is, and that's what we should aspire for. Thank you very much.